ॐ सहनाववतु सहनौ भुनक्तु सहवीर्यं करवावहै तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु मा विद्विषावहै ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः चैतन्यं सर्वगं सर्वं सर्वभूतगुहाशयं यत् सर्वविषयातीतं तस्मै सर्वविदे नमः. Very good. Welcome back. Just check this. It's looking okay. We continue our study of, I think I said chapter 18 last week. It's chapter 18 of the Bhagavad Gita we study on Saturdays. On Sundays, this is chapter 13. By the way, when we conclude this chapter, I think two more classes, we'll take a summer break. And just to give you a heads up, we often, before the pandemic, we used to do that regularly. So we'll take a summer break and then resume this class in fall. That also gives us the ability to shift our satsang to the evening. And it's so lovely. We've always enjoyed sitting outside in the garden to have satsang on Sunday evening. So we'll be resuming that when we finish this chapter. This is a long text. We're going to be studying this for a while, so we might as well take a break. The current chapter, chapter 13, achakshustva, this very odd term with a reference to the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, just a little more insight. Literally, it means eyelessness, showing how if you give a literal translation to Sanskrit terminology, it doesn't really make sense. What it refers to is the senses. By the way, when we say the senses, in a Vedantic context, senses are six in number, not five. What is number six? You'll remember, mind, antakarana. So five senses are pointed out into the world, and there's the inner sense, antakarana, mind. And the word achakshustva really extends, is meant to extend to all six of these senses to indicate that your swabhava, your true nature, is absolutely independent of these six senses and independent in particular, utterly unaffected by these six. This is crucial. This word shuddha, pure, comes again and again in this chapter, and it's used in the sense of being untainted by external influences. You know, you can all, it's easy to get that your true nature is consciousness, and you don't have to be a dedicated Vedantin to come to that understanding that your true nature is just, you are a conscious being in essence. But the nature of that consciousness is something further to be understood. Conventionally, you can think that you are consciousness, a conscious being, but a conscious being who's affected by anything that happens out here in the world, and certainly affected by everything that happens in your mind. So we understand consciousness then to be utterly unaffected by the five external senses, which means nothing in the world, outside world, can affect you in a negative sense, can hurt you, can threaten you. And similarly, the inner sense, mind. Nothing in your mind can threaten you. Of course, all of this is based on our profound understanding. Shankara has laid it out so brilliantly here that your consciousness, let's just make this connection very clear. How can we say, almost sounds dogmatic, does it? Consciousness isn't affected by anything. Why?
because Shankara said so. That's dogmatism. We absolutely don't follow that approach here. Why can we say that consciousness isn't affected by anything out there in the world, by anything here in your mind? It's not Shankara's dogmatic declaration. It is the fact, a fact that you can discover for yourself, and that fact is your consciousness is unchanging. Avikari. Vikari, subject to change. Avikari, not subject to change. And this is not a dogmatic assertion. This is a truth you can discover for yourself. You can close your eyes. You need not close your eyes. Through a process of introspection, you can not, I won't say easily, but with the help of these teachings, you can certainly appreciate the truth of the fact. Your mind changes, perceptions change, consciousness doesn't change. And having personally discovered it, not a matter of belief, not a matter of accepting some dogmatic statements, you personally recognize that your consciousness, your in quotation marks, or your Y-O-U apostrophe R-E, that was nice. So the consciousness which you are, that consciousness is unaffected because it's unchanging. It's kind of the central theme of this chapter. And with that introduction, we will pick up the thread on verse 15. Yes. Amanaskasya shuddhasya, amanaskasya shuddhasya, katam tatsyadvayam mama, katam tatsyadvayam mama, amanas tvavikaritve, amanas tvavikaritve, videha vyapino mama, videha vyapino mama. Just to introduce this next section of verses, we've already seen this truth that your consciousness is unchanging, therefore unaffected. This has been established through Shruti and Yukti and Anubhava. So Anubhava is a constant thread. Yukti was the first part of this chapter, and if you remember last class, was Shruti, scriptural references. Having concluded that, the next section, Shankara takes, shifts his focus to the pala, the fruits of this understanding, or maybe better said, the consequences of this understanding. In American English, we all like to say, so what? And that's a legitimate question. It's a very important question. So here we have Shankara's answer to so what, meaning the consequences of gaining this understanding. And in verse 15, Shankara begins, starting the second line, Shankara phrases a question. Katam, how, mama, me, for me, how, tat dvayam syat, how could there be duality for me? For me, for what kind of me? The rest of the verse talks about what kind of me. Back up at the top. For me, the one who is amanaskasya, free from mind, and shuddhasya, utterly, there's a word shuddha again, utterly unaffected by anything out there in the world. You can break this down. Amanaskasya, sense organ number 6. Shuddhasya, sense organs 1 through 5. You're not affected by anything. Actually, the context here, Shankara's leading question is, how could there be duality for me, the one who has no mind or senses? I'm paraphrasing. And that's an interesting observation, because in the absence of your, just a little mental experiment, in the absence of your mind and sense organs, would you experience duality? It's interesting just to reflect on that. And a good example is deep sleep. In deep sleep, your mind is in a state of resolution. In deep sleep, your senses don't function. Do you experience any duality in deep sleep? None whatsoever. Same is true in deep samadhi. So this, again, is not a dogmatic assertion. It's something that you can verify, that your consciousness is being independent of the mind and senses. It is free from this duality. He continues to explain that in the second half. He says, amanastva avikaditve, when given the fact that your true, actually he's talking in first person here, given the fact that my true nature has amanastva, is free from the mind, and avikaritva, and free from change, mindless and changeless. Interesting, mindless in common talk is a negative term, right? But here we're using the term mindless in a very profound way. Mindfulness in your day-to-day life is crucial. It's important to be mindful, to be alert, to be careful about what you say and do. So don't confuse these two things. So mindfulness as sadhana is extremely important. The mindlessness we're talking about here is at a deeper level, at an existential level. Your true nature being independent of the mind, and avikari, changeless. And so Shankara concludes, how could there be duality for me? In the last line, mama, for me, the one who is the deha vyapinaha. For me, the one who is videha, without a physical body, without the limitations of the body, and therefore vyapinaha. Vyapi means that which is all pervasive. Another common conclusion, we've said before that, or I said at the outset, that it's easy to get to the fact that you are a conscious being in a fundamental sense. But then we went on to say that, yes, you're a conscious being, but you're affected by everything out there. And here's a further observation by Shankaracharya. A common mistake is to think, I am a conscious being inside this body. Now, that's an interesting statement, because at one level it's true. I am a conscious being inside this body. Does that mean I'm stuck inside this body? The body is like, you won't like this metaphor. The body is like a sausage. And you may not, you don't want to know what sausage is in European culture. Don't. Honestly, sausage is the casing. Sorry to share this with you, but it makes a point about the body. Sausage is pig intestine, is the casing, and it's filled with chopped up varieties of meat with spices. That's European sausage. Not very appealing, but I find it a particularly good metaphor for the physical body, because it has, like sausage has this casing. Your body has a casing, skin. And like the sausage is full of all this meat, our bodies are full of all these organs. So anyway, to me that, I You may not like that metaphor, but to me it's very vivid. And by the way, there are plenty of texts that describe the body in far more vile ways. There are plenty of texts that point to the fact that, right, I don't know, why am I in this? I don't know. Shankara says videha, so this is why. So right now, your body is full of excrement that you haven't passed yet. And there are plenty of texts that like to point that out, that your body is full of filth. They use language like that. Anyway, so here Shankara points out, thank goodness you are videha. You are not consciousness stuck inside this filthy body like a sausage, like meat is stuck inside of a sausage. You are absolutely independent of the body, which means you can say that consciousness dwells in the body, but it doesn't only dwell in that body. Shankara points out, vyapinaha, that consciousness is sarva vyapi, all pervasive. Just like space pervades this room and pervades this body, in the same way, consciousness pervades the universe and is present in your body. So Shankara says, there's a little bit of methodology here, and that is, when you negate, in fact, this is the kind of the theme of the whole chapter, when you negate false assumptions about who you are, what's left? That's how it works. It's all negation. In fact, in our next class, and we won't get there today, in our next class we're going to get on some very tough meaning strong negation. So Vedanta, as you've heard me say before, is primarily negation. When you remove all the superimposition, that fancy word, when you remove all the false identification, all the false assumptions about who you are, what's left? What's left is unconditioned, uncreated consciousness. That's quite a good definition. Unconditioned, meaning not affected by anything, and uncreated, unchanging, eternal consciousness. Okay, let's continue. Ityetad yavadajnanam, ityetad yavadajnanam, tavat karyam mama bhavata, tavat karyam mama bhavata, nitya muktasya shuddhasya, nitya muktasya shuddhasya, buddhasya cha sada mama. Buddhasya cha sada mama. Iti etat, this being so, yavat ajnanam mama, when I was ignorant. Who is speaking? This is Shankaracharya speaking to us. And he says, yavat ajnanam mama, when I was ignorant, tavat karyam abhavat mama, then I had karyam, I had responsibilities to do. When I was ignorant, I had responsibilities to do. What kind of responsibilities? Well, I'm not sure how to handle this. Let us, first of all, we don't know exactly when he got enlightened. By the way, there are these stories about the life of Shankaracharya in their two biographies, two traditional biographies of Shankaracharya. And please, If you read them in translation or in the Sanskrit, please don't assume their literal truth about Shankaracharya's life, because they have him flying through the air, they have him changing the course of rivers, they have him assuming other bodies and all of this stuff. And, you know, to me, and you may feel differently, but to me, this demeans Shankaracharya by turning him into a fictional character. Shankaracharya was not a fictional character. He was a person like you and me who lived long ago and who taught Vedanta. So, you know, you have to understand these old biographies in context. Our modern view of biography is to be as accurate and objective as possible. That's how we understand. Not that biographies are always accurate and objective. They're usually full of flaws. No book is perfect. No biography is perfect. But the intent of modern biographies is to be accurate and unbiased. That wasn't the case 1,000 years ago. If you were 1,200 years ago, if you were a biographer 1,200 years ago, your job in writing the biography would be to praise the person as much as possible, including making up your own stories of praise. You're required to do that, because the purpose of biography in those days was to praise. I think there's a fancy academic term for this. I've never used this term. I think it's pronounced hagiography. Hagiography, if I understand that word properly, and I've never even used the word before. It's a big word, and I think it's an academic word used to refer to these old biographies that they don't care about accuracy, they care about praise. Keep that in mind. So suppose we just erase all of those stories about Shankara. And I think it's not a bad idea, because they are, almost every one of those stories are fictitious in some way. So let's just imagine there was a remember now here, before enlightenment. He says, Yavat Ajnanam Mama. When I had ignorance, before I was enlightened. What was Shankara like before he was enlightened? Set all those stories aside. So Shankara obviously had teachers. In fact, we have record of a teacher named Govinda who taught him. So we can imagine Shankara as a student being taught by his teacher, Govinda. And as a young student, he was still ignorant. Then what were his duties at that time? Well, one duty was to study. He says, karyam. He says, mama karyam abhavat. For me, before I was enlightened, I had certain duties to perform. What were the duties of the young, unenlightened Shankara? The duties included study. The duties would have included taking care of his guru. So there was a tradition in those days that the students would go out and collect bhiksha, alms, and bring that bhiksha back to feed the guru and the other students. So that was another karyam, another responsibility for Shankara. And another responsibility he's going to refer to in the next verse is his sadhana, including meditation. So here are three examples of responsibilities for the young, unenlightened Shankaracharya. In fact, we can't call him Shankaracharya, we'll call him little Shankar. Chota Shankar, this little boy, this boy. Anyway, I'm just making this up. So he had some responsibilities as a young student, responsibilities to study, responsibility to take care of his guru, responsibilities to meditate. Now, continuing. Then, Tavat karyam mama abhavat. Before I was enlightened, I had these responsibilities, even though, and you have to add that even though here, and that's just a stylistic thing, even though Shankara says, I had these responsibilities even though I was nitya mukta, eternally free, shuddha, pure, meaning untainted, and Buddha, enlightened. Now, first of all, can you make out from his statement that he's paraphrasing himself? Because in Shankara's commentaries, he loved to, I put it up on the board several classes ago, his favorite expression, nitya shuddha buddha mukta swabhava. That's his favorite expression. Nitya shuddha, that the true nature, swabhava, the true nature of Atma, is nitya shuddha, eternally pure, meaning never affected by anything. Nitya buddha, eternally enlightened. Atma doesn't get enlightened. Ignorance lies in the mind. Enlightenment takes place when the mind is freed from ignorance. Atma doesn't have ignorance. Atma isn't affected by ignorance. Therefore, Atma is nitya buddha, eternally enlightened, and nitya mukta, eternally free, not needing liberation. Atma doesn't say, free me. The individual jiva says, I'm suffering. Free me from suffering. Atma doesn't suffer. Unaffected, untainted, unchanging. So here Shankara paraphrases himself in this verse. So he says, for me, the one who is eternally free, eternally pure, eternally enlightened, for me, there were certain responsibilities when I was still ignorant. Responsibilities like study, taking care of guru, and meditation. And then what? So this idea is concluded in the next verse. Samadhirva, 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 karyam vanyat kuto bhavet, karyam chanyat kuto bhavet, mam hidhyatva cha buddhva cha, mam hidhyatva cha buddhva cha, manyate krita krityatam, manyate krita krityatam. Good. No problem. So he says, in the second line, so first of all, the context is prior verse. He said, before I was enlightened, I had responsibilities. But now he's enlightened. That's the context of this next verse. Shankara is the Shankara who's speaking to us through these verses is not the child, that Chota Shankara. One who's speaking to us is the great Shankaracharya, who says in the second line, kutaha bhavet, how could there be any karyam, anything that needs to be done for me? How could I have any responsibilities, any work to do, whether it is samadhi, first line, meditation, va asamadhi. Now, asamadhi means means responsibilities other than samadhi, which would include study, which would include getting food for his guru and everything else. And he says, va, in the second line, va anyat, or anything else. Kutaha bhaved, how could there be any responsibilities for me now, after being enlightened? Done, right? Enlightened means In fact, look at the last line. It says, manyate krita krityatam. Manyate. It is understood that there is krita krityatam. Literally, often translated as fulfillment, but it's nice to get inside the word. Krita kritya. Anything that is kritya, that needs to be done, is krita done. All that needs to be done is done. Krita, by the way, means the same as karya. They're synonyms. First half and a prior verse use that word karyam, something that is to be done, a responsibility. So here, instead of karyam, the word used is kritya. So kritya, anything that needs to be done is krita done. I've used this metaphor previously. Imagine having a you have a to-do list, right? Everyone has some kind of to-do list. Imagine a to-do list for your entire life. How long would that to-do list be for your entire life? And imagine having that to-do life for your entire, that to-do list for your entire life, and having every single item checked off. Krita krityatam. That's what the word suggests. A state of completion. A state of utter fulfillment is what's meant here. So let's see the rest of the verse, and then I need to make some up. Actually, let's explain further here. So for me, where am I? Here. Okay. For me, as I am, this is Shankara talking to us, right? So he says, being enlightened, I'm paraphrasing, being enlightened, I have krita krityata. I have this utter fulfillment, this completion. For me, how could there be anything left to be accomplished? How could there be a need for me to continue performing sadhana, meditation? How could there be a need for me for study? Studies have been fruitful. How could there be a need for me to continue hanging out with my teacher and taking care of him? So Shankara has fulfilled his responsibilities. He's free to go. And free to go, why? So how could there be any responsibilities for me? And the third line, we have to finish up, the dhyatva mam, he indeed, or because dhyatva mam, having meditated on myself, and meditated here in a sense of performing self-inquiry. And I'm being a little fussy now, because strictly, you know, Shankara is a great scholar, and he's not going to make a mistake by saying you have to meditate on Atma. Just before I explain, can you see where I'm going with this? Atma is not a thing you can meditate on. Atma is you. Atma is the meditator, not an object of meditation, right? So then when Shankara says, mam dhyatva, having meditated on myself, you can't take him literally. He can't mean that literally. So I'm suggesting that by dhyatva, he means having done self-inquiry. Having inquired, dhyatva mam, I'll paraphrase, having inquired into my true nature, buddhva cha, and having discovered my true nature, having become enlightened. So the whole verse now, having become enlightened, having performed self-inquiry, and having become enlightened, that's the third line, having done that, karyam cha kutaha bhavet, how could there be anything further for me to do. Manyate krita krityatam. When I consider myself, when I find myself to be utterly fulfilled, utterly, that sense of completion, I can't find a better term, that sense of utter completion. Anything that needs to be done has been done. So this is before enlightenment, after enlightenment. Before we move on, there's an important question to ask here, and that is, Shankara says, there's nothing for me to do. I don't have to take care of my guru anymore, so I'm just going to let him starve. So sorry, I'm being a little silly. But so Shankara doesn't feel a responsibility to take care of his guru. But when he sees his guru is hungry, what would prevent him from taking care of guru? Notice the actions can be the same, the motivation changes. You all know the famous Buddhist story. The master tells his disciple, before I was enlightened, I chopped wood and carried water. Now that I'm enlightened, I chop wood and carry water. But there's a huge shift. Chopping wood and carrying water was a burden. It was a responsibility previously. After enlightenment, it's no longer a burden, no longer a responsibility. So for Shankara, having a sense of fulfillment, what does he have to lose by going into the village and collecting some food for his guru? Nothing to lose. So he'll continue to do that. He may even continue to study. Why not? The study, by the way, you know, it's not like study is so unpleasant. I think we seem to be enjoying the study well enough. Although I remember in college some calculus courses and stuff, which I don't think they were that enjoyable. Anyway, this study is obviously very enjoyable, so why should he stop studying? He no longer has a responsibility to study, but what would prevent him from studying? And finally, meditation. So he says at the top, for me, there's no need to meditate. Would he suddenly become allergic to meditation? Meditation is something inherently enjoyable. Why would he stop? So the point I'm adding on to this verse, is when Shankaracharya says, I have the state of krita krityata, utter fulfillment, completion, it doesn't mean he's just going to sit and do nothing. It means he's going to continue to do exactly the same activities, but with a radical change of perspective. Before, he needed to do those activities for the sake of enlightenment. They were kadyam, there were responsibilities. They needed to be done. After enlightenment, that is over. Okay, that is over, meaning the need or responsibility is over. Next. Aham brahmasmi sarvosmi. Aham brahmasmi sarvosmi. Shuddho buddhosmyata sada. Shuddho buddhosmyata sada. Ajah sarvagahevaham. Ajah sarvagahevaham. Ajarashchamritokshayah. Ajaroshchabtokshayah. Aham brahma asmi. I am Brahman. Sarva asmi. I am everything. There's a lot to be said here. First, something you may take for granted. He says, I am Brahman. Sometimes what's significant is not what an author says, but what he or she doesn't say. And what Shankara doesn't say is, I became Brahman. I became all. I became, he doesn't even say, I became enlightened. In fact, he says, Nitya Buddha, I'm eternally enlightened. Nitya Muktaha, I'm eternally liberated. Shankara would never say, I became enlightened sitting in my guru's class on a Wednesday afternoon at 5 p.m. He couldn't say that because Shankara knows his true nature is not the individual body-mind complex who is sitting and learning from his teacher. Shankara knows himself as Satchidananda Atma. Atma doesn't get enlightened. So what Shankara doesn't say for our Sanskrit students, aham brahma abhavat. No, abhavam. No, became, past tense. I think the past tense, simple past is abhavam, if I remember right. Aham, brand new, you can look it up and correct me if I'm wrong. Aham brahma abhavam, I became Brahman. And in the second line, shuddha buddha asmi. There's that asmi again, present tense. He doesn't say abhavam, he doesn't say I became. So this is surprisingly significant. Not what he says, but what he doesn't say. Just an interesting observation. We use these expressions like to become enlightened, to become liberated, but an interesting definition of samsara. I'm trying to think if this comes from Shastra. I remember my guru saying this a lot, but I'm not sure it comes from Shastra. He liked to say that samsara is a life of becoming. Interesting definition. Samsara is a life of becoming. Becoming, and in other terms, you become more happy, you become more content, you become better. Of course, things don't always go in the direction you want. We know that life, sometimes you become happier, sometimes you become sadder, sometimes you become wealthier, sometimes you become less wealthy. Life is full of these ups and downs. You're constantly changing, and that's what Pujya Swamiji called a life of becoming. And the problem is that if enlightenment is one more thing you become. Remember our to-do list for your entire life? Is enlightenment one of them? In addition to everything else, let's see, I want a holiday in Hawaii, I want to do this, I want to do that, and I want to get enlightened, and this, and so just in this long list, one of the line items is gaining enlightenment. That perspective is inherently flawed. Enlightenment is not one of the things you want to accomplish in life. In fact, let's turn it around. Everything, this is a true statement, I'm checking myself very carefully. Everything you do in life, in a manner of speaking, is for the sake of enlightenment, in this sense. What you seek is contentment and perfect peace, right? So why do you do what you do every day? Why that whole to-do list for your life? All of it has to concern, all of it is concerned with your happiness and contentment and inner peace. The happiness and contentment and inner peace, which will never be fully attained even if you tick off every last item on that to-do list, the happiness and contentment and peace that can only be gained through enlightenment. So could we say then that all worldly activities are misdirected efforts? I'm trying to get the words very, very carefully now. All worldly activities are misdirected efforts to gain the perfect peace and contentment which is only possible through enlightenment. That sounds good. I'll say it again. All worldly activities are misdirected efforts to gain perfect peace and contentment, the perfect peace and contentment which can only be found through enlightenment. One more thing to add here. The commentator makes some interesting observations. He says that this is an instance, enlightenment, he says, is an instance of, and he uses a logical expression, praptasya praptihi, the attainment of what you already have. Very interesting expression. Enlightenment, according to the commentator, is the attainment of what you already have. In all the commentaries, the example they love to give is a woman who lost her necklace and spent all day looking for her necklace. And then she found it was around her neck all the time. Praptasya praptihi, gaining what you already have. Moksha is praptasya praptihi. It is the acquisition of what you already have. Okay, let's come back to the verse. So, there's more here. Aham brahmasmi. So far, we've been talking mostly about discovering your true nature to be uncreated, unchanging consciousness. And let me ask a trick question. When you discover that you are unborn, unchanging consciousness, when you gain that discovery, when you discover that truth about yourself, is that moksha? Is that enlightenment? I've already warned you it's a trick question. So there's actually something missing. And what's missing is, okay, I am unchanging consciousness, but what is all this? You all know well that we can express the ultimate teachings of Vedanta in three well-chosen words, tat, tvam, asi. So, you are that, tvam is you, your true nature, and that's been our discussion through the whole first part of this text so far. It's a discussion about your true nature. Commentators like to call it tvam pada vichara. Vichara, inquiry into the tvam pada, the word tvam, as it is found in the Mahavakya, tat tvam asi. But if you understand tvam, you still have to understand tat. So this expression, aham brahmasmi, goes beyond knowing yourself to be Satchidananda Atma, uncreated, unchanging consciousness. It goes beyond to understand that you are Brahman, and he says it a second time, Sarvaha Asmi, I am everything. This is actually a second, I'm pausing because what I'm about to say is technically wrong. So I'm warning you right now, what I'm about to say is technically wrong. What is technically wrong? Step one, discover your true nature as unchanging, uncreated consciousness. Step two, discover that consciousness is Brahman. Now, I said it's technically wrong. On a surface level, it makes sense. So you have to discover that you are Satchidananda Atma, pure consciousness. You have to discover ultimately that the consciousness which is your true nature, that consciousness is Brahman. And we can, at least in our minds, we can divide that up into these two steps. Step one, discover your true nature as Satchidananda Atma. Step two, discover that that consciousness is Brahman, is everything. So on one level it makes sense. Technically it's incorrect. Technically it's incorrect because the only time, this is subtle, and if you don't get it, don't even worry about it. The only way you can know yourself truly is to know yourself as Brahman. The only way you can know Brahman truly is to know Brahman as yourself. And if you don't understand that, it's okay. That's kind of a little subtle. And it's not our subject matter right now. So this text so far is primarily Tvam Pada Vichara. It's primarily an inquiry into your true nature. So we'll set Brahman aside, but it's important to know here, Brahman has done both steps, even though they're not two steps. Shankaracharya has recognized the truth of the Mahavakya, I am that. In fact, Aham Brahmasmi is one of the four commonly quoted Mahavakyas. Okay, so I am Brahman, I am everything, I am Shuddha, pure, unaffected, I am Buddha. So here he's paraphrasing himself once again. The word Sada, always. So Sada, always, Nitya, Sada Shuddha, Nitya Shuddha, Sada Buddha, Nitya Buddha. He's missing Nitya Mukta. So it's a partial paraphrase, but using the language that he likes so much. Asmi, ataha, therefore, ataha, therefore, asmi, I am thus. I am also ajaha, unborn, uncreated. I am sarvagaha, all pervasive, boundaryless, limitless. Eva aham, indeed, this I am. I am also ajaraha cha. That's especially important, at least for me right now, as I'm getting a little older and starting to deal with more of age-related issues with my body. So Shankara very kindly reminds me, ajaraha. There's no old age. Atma doesn't age. Body ages? Boy, does it. But Atma doesn't age. That Atma, your true self, is Amrita, immortal, and Akshayaha, undecaying, unceasing, unchanging. Good. I'll just share one more. I make some notes when I go through the commentary. I make a few notes to share with you. The commentator makes another at least I find it an interesting note, a contrast between Advaita Vedanta and Patanjala Yoga. Patanjala is a scholarly way of saying of Patanjali. So if you want to sound scholarly, say Patanjala Yoga. If you want to sound like a normal person, the Yoga of Patanjali. All right. Sorry, I've just been reading some scholarly papers, and that was somewhat in my mind. Anyway, according to Patanjali, according to some versions of Advaita Vedanta, which have been highly affected by the teachings of yoga. For example, the teachings of Vedanta that you find in the text Yoga Vasishta. The Advaita teachings and Yoga Vasishta are not the same as Shankara's teachings. There are minor but crucial differences. We're not going to go into all of that now, but let me share one example. In that other kind of Advaita, there's the teaching that, what is the term he uses? Prapancha Vilaya is a yogic term for the Vilaya dissolution. Prapancha refers to the world. And the idea is this. This is prominent, actually, in Yoga Vasishta. In order to, look at this gain, I have to edit myself. There's no becoming. But if you accept becoming, in order to reach non-duality, and reach in quotation marks, we don't accept that. You don't reach. Do you get that right? You don't reach non-duality. Praptasya praptihi. Non-duality is an already existent fact. But in this other school of thought, in order to reach non-duality, you have to get rid of duality. That's what this term means. Prapancha vilaya, the dissolution of the world. And you'll find terms like manonasha used extensively, destruction of the mind. And it's said very seriously. How can you be free if your mind has all these problems? Get rid of it. How can there be non-duality if there's a world of duality? Get rid of it. And so the commentator, in explaining this praptasya praptihi, he says that unlike these other traditions, some of this is in Patanjali's yoga, so a lot of this is in Yoga Vasishta. But these are teachings contrary to what Shankara is teaching us here, and I would say contrary to what the ancient rishis taught. Shankara follows the Upanishads very carefully. This is not a concept that's being put in the mouths of the ancient rishis. This is, in my view, a very correct interpretation of what the ancient rishis intended when they composed the Upanishads. They did not intend that you should reach non-duality. They rather taught that non-duality is an already existent fact, and you have to discover that truth. So just to share with you something from the commentator. Some quick announcements. We have a new support group called Samashraya, which is meant to support families and caregivers of those who suffer from mental illness. So it's for the caregivers and family members, not for the mentally ill persons. So there has been a new support group created by or led by Vasanti. That support group will meet today here at 4 o'clock. If you'd like to join, just talk to Vasanti. Also, I'll just announce this if you didn't hear in yesterday's classes. We're finally able to resume our yearly anniversary celebrations. 3 years in a row, we have not been able to celebrate our anniversary because of the pandemic, but this year we will do so, and we'll do so on June 3rd, which is a week from Saturday. So just mark your calendars. It'll be at the usual class time, so that's Saturday morning, June 3rd. Plan on joining us then. Okay, we'll conclude with our prayers. Om sarve bhavantu sukhinah, sarve santu niramayah, sarve bhadrani pashyantu, ma kashchid dukha bhag bhavet, asato ma satgamaya, tamaso ma jyotirgamaya, mrityorma amritangamaya. Om shanti shanti shanti. Om tat sat.